Hi, everyone. Welcome to Packers Unscripted from Packers.com. I'm Mike Spofford, sitting next to Wes Hodkiewicz. We're coming to you here from our studios at Lambeau Field. And Wes, as usual, when we reach this point in the week, we start to really look ahead at the Packers' next opponent. And for week three, that is the Cincinnati Bengals coming to Lambeau Field Sunday afternoon, a 3:25 Central Time kickoff here in Green Bay. And I think when you think about the Cincinnati Bengals, the first name, the first player that comes to mind, at least for me, is that wide receiver. There's A.J. Green. He's quite a talent.
Yeah, you want to talk about tough starts as far as what the Packers had to see. You get, well, obviously Doug Baldwin, you have to navigate him in week one. Then you see Julio Jones and now A.J. Green. Cincinnati's working through some things right now, as we were talking about in our pre-production meeting. I mean, 4.5 points per game right now they're averaging offensively, still looking for that first touchdown of the year.
Yeah.
But Green is still a guy that at any given moment, at any given time in a football game, assuming the Bengals are on offense, he's going to be able to get a touchdown for you. He's going to be able to get an explosive play. So I would think going into this contest, as many things as Cincinnati's trying to figure out, that's where this offense runs when it's at its most effective. It's when A.J. Green is making plays and Andy Dalton's getting him the ball. So I'm sure when they're scheming up, and you know, Marvin Lewis and his offensive coaches, while there's been some shuffling this past week, when they get on the field on Sunday, I'm assuming that's where they're going to be looking to feed the football.
Yeah, statistically, Green definitely the leader for them in the passing game. 10 catches for 141 yards through two games. Hasn't had, you know, that big game, but as you mentioned, the Bengals trying to figure some things out on offense. They got shut out in week one at home by a division rival in the Baltimore Ravens, and then only managed three field goals last Thursday night against the Houston Texans. So a team that's 0-2, they fired their offensive coordinator, a coach who had worked with Marvin Lewis in a couple different capacities for a long time, Ken Zampezi, if I'm saying that correctly. Yeah. He's out, and the Bengals now have had a little bit extra time here coming off of the Thursday game. And for me, you know, I don't like to get too caught up in records and stats and stuff like that. I look at motivation when it comes to professional athletes. This is going to be a highly motivated Cincinnati Bengals team on Sunday afternoon.
It will be, Mike. And I mean, this is the thing too, is historically, I mean, the Bengals have actually been a team that's sort of really cultivated a lot of head coaching talent, specifically through that offensive coordinator position. When you look at, you know, Jay Gruden coming through there, going from having his success in the AFL to becoming the head coach now in Washington. I mean, Hugh Jackson came through that program defensively. You also had Mike Zimmer. So they've had a lot of success with their coordinators. And for them to go this direction now, I think really speaks to what Marvin Lewis is looking to do in terms of finding a way to energize, finding a way to change things, and really, most importantly, just get this offense rolling. On paper, you know, Andy Dalton at times, he's been hit or miss, but they have three really talented running backs. You get Giovanni Bernard back. Obviously, Joe Mixon was very controversial during the draft process, but I don't think anyone's arguing with his athletic ability and what he offers in that regard. And Jeremy Hill's been a bell cow back for them in the past. Along with A.J. Green, I would have said it would have been very difficult to foresee them getting off to this slow of a start.
Yeah,
and again,
offensively,
reading all the stuff I have so far out of Cincinnati over the past week, I still think there's confidence, despite all the upheaval, despite all the narrative in the national media right now, that the Bengals feel they can turn this thing around and get themselves back on the right track.
Yeah, there's a lot of noise from the outside as to whether the Bengals should go with A.J. McCarron at quarterback over Andy Dalton. Should they go sign Colin Kaepernick because he's out there and available with the offense's struggles? I get the sense that internally Andy Dalton is still their guy. He's a guy. Now, the big knock on Marvin Lewis in this regime, so to speak, is they've never won a playoff game. But Andy Dalton has won his share of games in the NFL. He's gotten the Bengals to the playoffs a couple of times. I think they're committed to Andy Dalton. They know they have the talent in A.J. Green. You just rattled off all the running backs. All of those guys, they certainly bring something to the table. So I agree with you. I think they're confident that they can turn this thing around. And who knows, maybe they, you know, start to lick their chops a little bit in terms of coming in to face a Packers defense that's reeling a little bit from what the Atlanta Falcons just did to them.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's what, if you're looking from Cincinnati's perspective, they're going to be keeping their eyes on.
Right.
It's just really important, too, to remember. I mean, Andy Dalton's in his seventh NFL season right now. A lot of coaches, and I've made this point in the past too, Mike, don't survive one quarterback. If there's a quarterback change, if things go downhill, they make an adjustment. As we know with how the Bengals run their operation, they've been very dedicated to Marvin Lewis. And when everything kind of fell backwards with Carson Palmer, it was Andy Dalton that came in and took the reins and really got that turnaround and that rebuild accelerated. So there's a lot of equity built up with him and his game. It's been a slow start. Zero touchdowns, four interceptions, only completing 54% of his passes. But we're not talking about a second or third year quarterback that had some success and now is reeling. We're talking about a guy that's developed a lot of chemistry, a lot of trust in that locker room. And I have to imagine, regardless of what the record book says or what the scoring column reads, the Cincinnati Bengals are going to be coming into this game Sunday at Lambeau Field ready to try and get their offense back on the same page.
Yeah, and I think when you're trying to get a struggling offense going, sometimes you turn to the running game, and when you have a speedy guy like Bernard and a power guy like Mixon as a 1-2 combination, we may see them come into Lambeau Field and try to pound the football. But with that, we're going to throw it to a break. Back with more on Packers Unscripted right after this. Welcome back to Packers Unscripted. Mike Spofford here, Wes Hodkowitz over there. And Wes, continuing our breakdown of the Cincinnati Bengals, if we switch to the defensive side of the ball, the guy that jumps off the page is defensive lineman Geno Atkins. This Bengals defense has four sacks through two games. Geno Atkins has three of them. That's a guy that the Packers are definitely going to be aware of wherever he is on the field Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, the one thing that kind of gets lost in this whole narrative with the Bengals and the struggles they've had so far is the fact that their defense has actually kept them in all these ball games. Even when they have been able to score anything offensively, they've still been within arm's reach of the opponent.
Yeah,
Geno Atkins is a big part of that. They don't have Vontaze Burfict right now. He's serving a five-game suspension. He's obviously the cog at their linebacker position. So a lot of it has fallen on Atkins. I've used that example in the past. I mean, you look at him and Mike Daniels, they're kind of out of a similar mold, more sawed off, smaller defensive tackles. But when they get up underneath these interior offensive linemen, can really cause a lot of havoc. He's been doing it now for 5-6 years as well as anybody in the league. I think him and Aaron Donald are right up there in terms of the sack totals for defensive tackles in this league right now, true defensive tackles.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
that's going to be a major challenge for whether it's Corey Linsley, Jari Evans, Lane Taylor, whoever ends up lining up across from him. They've seen him a couple times already. They know his strength. They know his power. But it's certainly something you have to be prepared for, because the Cincinnati defense, it starts and stops with him.
Yeah, and when you talk out on the edge of this defensive line, I mean, I still remember the game in 2013 in Cincinnati and Michael Johnson,
right?
That big fourth down play, if I remember right, you know, he comes crashing in from his defensive end spot, not only stops the play but forces a fumble, completely changes that game. Now, Johnson hasn't recently put up the sack numbers that that maybe he did a few years ago, but and with the Packers, you know, still trying to sort out the injury situation with Bakhtiari and Bulaga at the offensive tackle spots, some things to figure out there, but Michael Johnson's a guy not to forget about.
Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong here, Mike, because you're obviously smarter than I am. Did he have was that a multi-sack game he ended up having two against Green Bay? Was that like two or three sacks?
I want to say maybe two sacks.
Yeah, it was pretty impactful. And again, that shows you what he can do. Obviously, he's a little bit up there in age now. You know, and I think he's around that, you know, 30, 31 mark, whatever that might be now. But whatever the case may be, another guy you have to take, you know, really keep into account and understand who's going to be there. Because the other thing is, too, this Bengals have invested so heavily into their secondary over the last few years. One of the things that they do really well, and Mike Daniels talked about it recently, about the coverage pressures, is that sometimes when you are able to hold, you know, an offense, the boundary guys to, you know, a containment factor, gives those guys in front a little more time to get after the quarterback. When Mike Zimmer was there all the way through in terms of how they pressure and how they generate pressure, it stayed true to that. And obviously Marvin Lewis in his own right, you know, has been a really good defensive mind in terms of what he's been able to accomplish there in Cincinnati over the years.
Yeah, I mean, and as you mentioned at the beginning of this segment, give them credit through these first two games for they've only allowed, I believe it's 37 points total through two games, and that's without Burfict, who really has been, you know, kind of the guy who makes it go for them defensively. In the secondary, the most recognizable name, Adam Jones at cornerback, the veteran there. And quickly on special teams, too, just to give a shout-out to Alex Erickson in the return game, former Wisconsin Badger, and actually from Darlington, Wisconsin, which is down near my old stomping grounds in the southwest corner of the state. So so a local guy, a Wisconsin guy, who will be getting a chance to play at Lambeau Field on Sunday. But yeah, this Bengals defense now, the Baltimore Ravens, the Houston Texans, the two offenses they face, certainly not what the Green Bay Packers bring to the table offensively, but the Packers also having some injury situations with their weapons, with Jordy Nelson and Randall Cobb. We don't necessarily know how that's going to look at the end of this week. So a lot of uncertainty here as we head into Sunday.
Yeah, and just to touch on, you mentioned Pac-Man Jones. He's been in the league now for a number of years, over a decade, I think, really. Yeah. You know, it's been interesting to see how he's evolved his game and reshaped himself over the years. George Aoki, one of the top safeties in the league for a number of years as well. So they have a lot of weapons. And as I mentioned earlier, the investment they've made at the cornerback position with, you know, Drake Kirkpatrick, Denard, William Jackson III, that's where I think there's been a big emphasis that they've put on. You have to remember the way that the Bengals do things, their personnel department, their coaching department is very intertwined, probably more so than any other team in the NFL. So the coaching staff, they understood what they needed. They got that done. There's been a consistent, concerted effort to making that happen. And for their purposes, I think the defense is where they want them to be right now, especially when you don't have Perfect. It's getting back to that offense and whether or not they can get on the same page and back on track.
Yeah, I would agree with you. But for now, I'm going to toss it to another break. Back with more on Packers Unscripted right after this. Welcome back to Packers Unscripted. Mike Spofford in this chair, Wes Hodkiewicz in that one. Wes, shifting gears back to the Packers here. A franchise record is on the verge of falling here as we head into week three of 2017, and I'm talking about the Packers' all-time sack record. Clay Matthews with 1.5 sacks in Atlanta. He is now at 74 in his career, which is a half sack behind Kabir Bajabiamila's franchise mark of 74.5. To clarify, sacks were not an official NFL statistic until 1982. So this franchise sack record is from 1982 to the present. But Clay Matthews on the verge of making some history here, and it was great to see him have as many frustrations as there were on the defensive side of the ball Sunday night in Atlanta. It was really good to see Matthews have the impactful game that he had.
He did. I mean, that was one thing Dom Capers said when he was addressing the media on Monday. They're really... Capers always has a little bit of a monologue at the beginning of his news conferences. He starts with positives, he'll talk about the negatives. His positives weren't a lot of them. He kept it pretty short on that end of it and then talked about some of the areas where the Packers need to improve. But as the course of the press conference went on, I mean, really giving and tipping his cap a little bit to Matthews. A lot was asked of Clay in that game. He played a lot of snaps, as we've talked about before, but I thought actually was pretty impactful. Now, mind you, they also lost Ryan Schrader, their right tackle, to a concussion. So there were some opportunities maybe there that Schrader wouldn't potentially be as prone to giving up. But the thing that I've liked about Matthews so far earlier in the season is he looks so much more healthy. He was within a few fingertips of getting a sack against Russell Wilson as well in week one.
No doubt.
And if it's not Russell Wilson, a lot of quarterbacks are going to be going down there. He's just, you know, with having that scrambling mentality, a little bit more compact, was able to find his way to, you know, get out of that situation. But that being said, him and Nick Perry talked about it from the start of the season. The Packers are going to be counting on both of them. It's going to be a big part of this pass rush this year. They're going to need them healthy. And so far, things have looked good for Matthews. And now, as you mentioned, trying to get that other half sack, maybe even a full one to take that record in his sole possession.
Yeah, and you know me. I like to get into the historical stats and stuff once in a while. So I'll throw this out there to you. Ezra Johnson, who was a big sack artist when I was growing up, in the late 70s, early 80s for the Packers. As I said, sacks became an official statistic in 82, which was kind of about halfway through Ezra Johnson's career. I've seen some retrospectives that have gone back and credited Johnson with approximately 84 sacks during his time with the Packers. So that's 9.5 more than KGB had. Right. So that being said, I think when it's all said and done, I think whichever sack record you wanna say, I think Clay Matthews is going to have it here for Green Bay eventually. But you mentioned it. He looks healthier. We saw when he was dealing with that shoulder injury down the stretch last year, we saw a couple of high impact plays against Minnesota in that Christmas time game at Lambeau Field, in the wild card game against the Giants with the sack fumble and kind of the funny sequence there where some people thought the play was dead. But when Clay Matthews is healthy, those types of impact are not here and there. It's more consistent. And I think the start he's had these first couple of weeks, it's something that he definitely wants to continue. And the Packers defense needs it to continue because he's so important to what Dom Capers likes to do.
He really is. And I had a chance last week, I was asking him about that dime rush package. You know, you don't have Julius Peppers anymore. Dayton Jones is no longer there. But they bring in Ahmad Brooks, and they've only had 6 snaps with him so far before he ended up sustaining that unfortunate concussion off kind of a freak situation. So once he's healthy, once Brooks is healthy, to see how Capers can really utilize and manipulate offenses with those three guys and how they want to line guys up. Like I said, we only saw Brooks for a handful of snaps, but you know, you saw Matthews and Perry rushing from the inside of that dime defense.
Right.
You saw them working different combinations. That's where Clay Matthews in particular is at his best, when guys can't really cue in on where he's going to be lining up and how he's going to be, you know, deployed in a defensive scheme. So that's, I think, going to be the ultimate thing. If you can keep Perry and Matthews healthy, get Brooks back on the field and get him caught up to the defense, those three guys together, I think, can be a really formidable trio.
Yeah, I find it interesting what Dom Capers likes to do in terms of the way he moves those guys around and they attack from different spots. Because if you're a center or a guard for the other team, you're dealing a handful of snaps, you know, most of your snaps against, you know, the Mike Daniels and the Kenny Clarks right. of the world. And then all of a sudden on third down, you've got this speed rusher coming at you. Now, those guys on the interior aren't so much out on the island, you know, as those out on the edge. It's not always strictly a one-on-one situation, but it's a challenge to have to block Mike Daniels for a couple plays, and then all of a sudden Clay Matthews is coming at you.
And the biggest thing I said as far as a positive from that Seattle game is the fact that Mike Daniels, 2 sacks, 1 came out of the base defense, 1 came out of the dime. When you're getting that kind of contributions across the board, that's where Dom Capers' defense is at its best, and Clay Matthews a lot of times plays into that.
Yeah, for sure. Before we go, Wes, let's take care of a little sponsor business here. Attention Packers fans, we're calling you to fill up with Campbell's Chunky Chicken Noodle Soup. We're talking delicious, hearty soup packaged in an exclusive Packers Superfan can. These cans are limited edition for all you football fanatics out there, so don't miss out. Go on, huddle up, and fill up with this hearty soup, Chunky Soup, the official soup partner of the Green Bay Packers. Back with more on Packers Unscripted right after this. Welcome back to Packers Unscripted. Mike Spofford next to Wes Hodkowitz. And Wes, interesting topic here to talk about as we wrap up the show today. 25 years ago today, when we're taping this being September 20th, 2017, 25 years ago today is when Brett Favre stepped in for Don Majkowski against the Cincinnati Bengals, coincidentally. And just the other day, here in Green Bay, in the village of Ashwaubenon, Ron Wolf Way was dedicated, a street named after the Packers general manager who had acquired Brett Favre, led the renaissance of the Green Bay Packers in the 1990s to back-to-back Super Bowl appearances and won championship. Quite an honor for Mr. Wolf, the Pro Football Hall of Fame general manager, and well-deserved.
Yeah, and you could just see that they did a ceremony presentation dedicating the road to him, had all of his family and friends there, a lot of the Packers personnel department, including Ted Thompson, attended the ceremony, and just how much pride he has, not only in getting the road, obviously that goes without saying, but he did his little podium, this short speech, very short, as you can imagine with Ron Wolf. He lets everybody else do the talking. But he held his granddaughter, Daisy, who's actually the daughter of Packers director of football operations, Elliot Wolf. And he even said afterwards that's really his biggest pride and joy out of everything he's accomplished, the Pro Football Hall of Fame, all those accolades. How much pride he takes in his family and to all the things he accomplished, he turned all of them over to other people. It was, you know, Mike Holmgren for coaching the way he did, Brett Favre for becoming the quarterback that he was. Reggie White for having the renaissance and carrying on his success into Green Bay after so many good years in Philadelphia. But at the end of the day, I think the one thing that really goes without saying is Ron Wolf is the one that put all the chess pieces on the board.
Yep.
And for that, as Mark Murphy, the Packers president and CEO, said, I mean, this organization is owes him a great debt of gratitude.
That's what you're trying
you got
to
it.
Say.
Yeah, for what he did here.
Yeah, the line I think that came out of the media press conference there was he put the title back in Title Town,
right.
And that's really the best way you can say it. I've talked to Bob Harlan many times, other reporters have, about the Renaissance in the 90s, and he always mentions four people who were the key to it: Ron Wolf, Mike Holmgren, Brett Favre, and Reggie White. Well, it was Ron Wolf who made the moves to get those other three. Ron Wolf was the first one who was brought in and you know, changed a franchise, changed the culture around here, everything about it, was given full control of the football operation in the hands of that one man, the general manager, which had not been the case in the past,
right.
in the post-Lombardi era. So a lot of changes that he was responsible for, and changes for the better.
Yeah, and Bob Harlan's in the same conversation. I mean, hiring Ron Wolf after, you know, Wolf had been, you know, let go in Tampa a decade earlier. They weren't hiring a lot of older GMs at that point in time. It's incredible. I mean, they really, you needed snake eyes to come up like five straight times for the Packers to have the kind of success that they did and to be able to turn this thing around after so many years of mediocrity, with all due respect to the people that were involved with it. But, you know, from a record standpoint and a championship standpoint, it had been 29 years between those Super Bowl titles. Ron Wolf ultimately is the one that got the Packers in that position again.
Yeah, and in his self-deprecating way, he'll always talk about his failures early on with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and he does that to give credit to the others who are around
right.
him that helped make the success in Green Bay possible. But with that, we're going to call it a wrap on this edition of Packers Unscripted. Be sure to follow all of our coverage of the team on Packers.com, on Twitter. He's at Wes Hodd. I'm at Mike Spofford, at Packers for the team account. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. See you next time.